Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's March 19th, 2021 program, Falling Behind, Solving Oregon's Addiction Crisis. This is the 25th program of our 2020-2021 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page, and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Mondays at 7 p.m. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, University of Oregon, Peace Health, and Lane Community College, as well as generous support from the City of Eugene and from Lane County. In today's program, we welcome presenters Tiffany Brown, Mike Marshall, Terry Morgan, and Reginald Richardson. Tiffany Brown is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a senior lecturer and clinical director in the University of Oregon Couples and Family Therapy Graduate Program. Mike Marshall is co-founder and director of Oregon Recovers. Terry Morgan is the program coordinator at Springfield Treatment Center. And Reginald Richardson is executive director of the Oregon Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. A 2019 report from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission found that Oregon, quote, ranks among the most challenged states in the nation for substance abuse and mental health problems, while at the same time ranking among the worst states for access and engagement with care, end quote. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health in 2017 found that Oregon ranked first nationwide in marijuana use and pain reliever misuse, second in methamphetamine use, fourth in cocaine use, and fourth in both alcohol use disorders and substance use disorders. Drug use among youth in Oregon is an area of particular concern, as Oregon adolescents used marijuana at the second highest rate in the nation after recreational marijuana sales kicked off in 2015, according to a recent study from a national drug testing company. Even as one of the state's largest mental health and addiction services provider seeks an emergency bailout, cities across the state, from Eugene to Medford, Portland to Bend, have declared addiction a public health crisis. Experts on this panel will describe the steps being taken to address this monumental challenge and tell how we can work to support efforts to make Oregon a leader in recovery. Our format today includes a question and answer period with City Club members via Zoom.
Hello, my name is Andrew Kallick, and I'm a member of the program committee of the City Club of Eugene and the coordinator of today's program. Thank you so much for dialing in to this important conversation about addiction in Oregon. We have a tremendous panel for you. Each of them is going to give an opening statement followed by some conversational questions and answers. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over the mic to Dr. Reginald Richard.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the challenges and opportunities regarding Oregon's addiction crisis. I'm Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. There are four items I want to talk about. I'm going to talk about Oregon's challenges. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, the statewide strategic plan, and key elements of the plan, and then we'll get into questions and answers. This is a data chart that shows some of the challenges that we are facing here in Oregon. Oregon has some of the highest rates of substance use and substance use disorders in the nation. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, Oregon is number one in regards to prescription opioid misuse, number two in illicit drug use, number three in cocaine use, Number 5 in substance use disorder. Number 6 as it relates to heroin use. Also number 6 as it relates to methamphetamine use. And Oregon ranks 47th in people needing treatment but not receiving it. Nearly 1 in 10 Oregonians 12 and older have a substance use disorder, with alcohol use disorder being the most common type, impacting more than 7% of all Oregonians. Alcohol is the third leading cause of preventable death in our state. And recently, according to a report by Eco Northwest, Oregon's total cost of excessive alcohol use is roughly $4.8 billion in 2019. That comes from the loss of labor productivity, the expenses related to criminal justice, motor vehicle crashes, healthcare, education, and social welfare. 15.8% of Oregon's state budget was spent on problems associated with substance misuse. For example, spending in the areas of corrections, in the court system, or child welfare. Less than 1% of the state's budget was dedicated to direct spending, for example, in the areas of prevention and treatment. In part, these challenges have led the legislature to require that the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission to create a comprehensive statewide strategic plan. I want to provide a little bit of a brief overview of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission's statewide strategic plan. Let me tell you a little bit about the commission. We are an independent state agency. We were created in 2009 by the Oregon Legislature to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of state and local prevention, treatment, and recovery services. We are a policy board charged in part with developing the statewide strategic plan, setting policies for prevention, treatment, and recovery supports. We are a 19-member policy board. We have one member that is appointed by the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, one member appointed by the President of the Senate, and one appointed by the House Speaker. We also have representatives from the CCOs and from the Oregon Health Authority Behavioral Health Director is also a member. The remaining members of the commission are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. No more than 25% of members can be representatives from the criminal justice system. Give you a little bit of an overview of the statewide strategic plan. As a part of the information gathering process, the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission and its contractor reviewed hundreds of pages of documents, conducted 14 listening sessions around the state, and met with agency directors and their staff. This preliminary work helped the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission focus the strategic plan on measurable health, social, and economic improvements, and establish a process for monitoring and reporting progress. The statewide strategic plan builds on a coordinated state substance use system that aligns all state agencies' efforts as it relates to substance misuse. It includes strategies and activities, establishes a baseline for current state spending, develops processes for monitoring and changes in spending and reinvesting those cost savings over time. And we have submitted our plan last February 2020 to the legislature in advance of the July 20th deadline. Our plan has key elements. There are 4 impacts. When we implement the plan completely, what we hope to see happen is impact number 1, which is to reduce substance use disorders and to increase recovery rates. Our 2nd impact is to reduce alcohol, tobacco, and other drug-related deaths, reduce alcohol, tobacco, and other related health disparities, and finally, to reduce the economic burden of substance misuse on the Oregon state budget. With these impacts, there are 4 goals that roll up to the ultimate impacts, and they are: 1, implement a statewide system that ensures that substance misuse policies, practices, and investments and efforts are effective and result in a healthy and thriving individuals and communities. Our 2nd goal is to increase the impact of substance misuse prevention strategies across the lifespan. And 3rd, to increase rapid access to effective SUD treatment across the lifespan. And finally, our 4th goal is to increase access to recovery supports across the lifespan. I'm looking forward to getting into our discussion soon, but right now I'm going to turn it over to Terry Morgan for her presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson. I appreciate the lead off there. My name is Terry Morgan. I am the program coordinator at Springfield Treatment Center. I am a certified alcohol and drug counselor level 2, and I'm also a person in long-term recovery from substance abuse. I'm just going to give you a little bit of background about my story and hopefully give you some insight to what it's like living with an addiction. So I started my journey into substance abuse when I was a teenager. I tried alcohol for the first time when I was in middle school. I thought it was super cool and sneaky to take alcohol out of my parents' liquor cabinet, put it in a little Tupperware container and sneak it into school. I had it in my locker. One of my friends told on me. They were, you know, concerned about me. I got called into the principal's office. I had taken a sip of it. I thought it was horrible. I got called into the principal's office and questioned about it. It was a good student. I had good grades. I loved school, and you know, I came from a stable family, and so I got a little warning from my school: please don't ever do it again, and sent on my way. I tried marijuana when I was in high school. I started smoking cigarettes when I was in high school. I thought marijuana was horrible. I tried it once. It made me super sick, and I hated it. So the marijuana that I had, I got rid of, gave it to a friend. He got in trouble with it at school, got found on his person. The principal asked him where he got it from. He said he got it from me. So here I am getting called into the principal's office again. Again, I'm a good student. I come from a good family, never been in trouble before. And I talked my way out of it. You would think that that would have put me on the straight and narrow path, but what it did was reinforce this idea that I could talk my way out of anything, which sort of gave me this internal permission to, you know, to get away with stuff. As I got older, my life took a turn. I got pregnant when I was 16 years old, had my daughter, first child with me as I walked down the aisle and graduated with my high school class. And was a mom for many years. And then when my first marriage started falling apart, I started drinking and learned at that time that alcohol was a great way to cope with feelings. And I learned that I like to do things to excess. So I don't just drink one or two drinks and call it good. I drink everything that I have available to me and more. My drinking led me to an unhealthy relationship with a gentleman who used drugs. We went to Las Vegas for a weekend when I was in my early 30s. And, you know, we went to Vegas to have fun, right? We were gambling and we were partying, and he offered me drugs. He offered me methamphetamine. And I thought to myself, what the heck? You know, I'm in Vegas, so I'm going to go ahead and use it. And I did not stop using methamphetamine for about 12 years. I became a daily drug user. My use then continued to the point where I had become incarcerated, homeless. My children were placed in protective custody. I was committing crimes to support my drug habit. And ultimately, my daughter was placed into DHS custody. And I was offered the opportunity to either get clean or not see my daughter again. And I had decided that I had had enough and I was ready to stop using drugs. And it took me 5 months of calling every day that I was able to get to a phone to see if there was a bed available at the residential treatment facility in my area. And before they actually had a spot open for me to be able to receive treatment services. Once I was admitted into treatment, I had made the decision that I wanted to live a life without the use of drugs and alcohol. And I have now been clean for almost 8 years. I have not used since then. I stopped smoking cigarettes at the same time. But I can tell you that near the end of that struggle of trying to find access to services, I remember calling my DHS caseworker and begging for her to send me to treatment anywhere that would take me because I felt like I wasn't going to live through my addiction and actually see my way into treatment. I can tell you, too, that one of the challenges that I faced throughout all my years of drug use and alcohol use was every time I had consequences from my drug use and was either hospitalized or addressed by law enforcement, not one time did anyone ever ask me if I wanted to stop using drugs. Not one time did anybody offer me a solution to my problem, which was my drug and alcohol use. It was sort of just shuffle me off and then see me again in another few months when I had another consequence for my drug use. Locally, what I'm seeing in our area, so I work for Springfield Treatment Center. We are a MAT provider, so we provide methadone and buprenorphine services for opiate use disorder, in addition to intensive outpatient program developed to address the continuing methamphetamine use or co-occurring methamphetamine use that we see in our population. But we have a lack of resources in our community to support people in recovery. You know, it's an ongoing conversation that we've been having, you know, throughout this state. I think, you know, I did some work a couple years ago with the City Council and the Lane County Board of Commissioners. We had, a resolution, presented to them and adopted declaring addiction a public health crisis. But we have a significant lack of services, not only for people to enter into treatment or receive the level of treatment that they need, but also, we really don't have any systems in place to support people in what I would call long-term recovery. It is incredibly challenging to use drugs and alcohol every day for 12 years and walk out of treatment knowing how to stay clean, knowing how to get a job again, knowing how to find housing. I think we can do a much better job of addressing that in this state. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to my friend Mike Marshall.
Terry, thank you. Thank you to the City Club of Eugene for inviting us today. And I feel honored to be on this panel. My name is Mike Marshall. I'm the co-founder and executive director of Oregon Recovers, a statewide advocacy campaign to address Oregon's addiction crisis. I'm also a person in long-term recovery, just like Terry, both alcohol and meth were huge parts of my story. I first got drunk when I was 9 years old. I come from an Irish Catholic family. Alcohol was what you consume when you were happy. It was what you consumed when you were sad, and it was what you consumed every day in between. And I think had my parents had a level of education to understand that if a child starts drinking before they're 15 in any meaningful way, they have a 40% chance of becoming addicted later in life. Whereas if they will wait until later in life, around 21, that goes down to about 8%. So, but that level of education has never existed. The alcohol industry is highly regarded throughout this country. It's an integral part of everybody's life. But it's one you're hearing all of us mention today because it's hugely important to address that relationship with alcohol in order to address Oregon's addiction crisis. Oregon Recovers came together 3 years ago. We brought the treatment providers together with the workforce folks to people like myself in recovery to address this crisis. Our analysis from the very beginning was, number one, there was no political will to change this because there was no one advocating to it. People, the recovery community was sort of defined by anonymity. Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous is the culture within the recovery community, which is you don't go out and talk about your recovery, number one. And then number two, we'd had back-to-back recessions where the state budget had been cut so draconianly, if that's a term, and there was nobody advocating for increased services. So there was no political will. As a consequence, there was really no one in charge. There was a lot of money going, not a lot, but there was money going into the system, and some was going to Department of Corrections, some to Health and Human Services, some outside the system, but nobody was trying to address how do we increase the recovery rates and reduce the addiction rates. And lastly, as a result of all that, there was no system of care. You need to understand that addiction recovery lived outside the healthcare system until the Affordable Care Act came along. So you had a lot of what I call mom and pop shops, but independent freestanding treatment providers that dealt with addiction on an acute level of care, but didn't recognize that it's a chronic disease that requires a lifetime of support and attention. And the healthcare system wasn't designed at all to deal with this very chronic condition. And so we set out from the very beginning to, number one, build the political will by building our community, the recovery community. So people like Terry and I who are in recovery, our friends and family, so the people who love us, and then the people who take care of us, the folks that work in the system, whether as a certified alcohol and drug counselor, the CEO of DePaul Treatment, or an addiction doctor at Kaiser Permanente. We are all in this together, and by bringing ourselves together, our goal is to build the power to address these issues. Our first action was to get the governor to declare addiction a public health crisis and to get the legislature to require that the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission develop a comprehensive strategic plan, which Dr. Richardson so eloquently presented earlier. That was not anything that's ever existed before, and it was delivered in February of 2020, just in time for COVID. And what it looks at, as he said, is not just that addiction is an acute problem, but actually looks at the fact that we need a integrated system of care with our healthcare system. It looks at prevention, that looks at a new paradigm around intervention that's not rooted in the criminal justice system, but in fact upstream in our healthcare system, which is not culturally or organizationally structured to do that. Provides treatment on demand. The notion of, you know, as Terry said, she was ready. There was no place for her to go, whether outpatient or residential. We need to provide services to people when they need them, just as we do with a heart attack patient or a diabetic. They get the care they need when they need it. Currently, we don't have a system that addresses addiction in the same way. And then lastly, recovery support is hugely important and has been sort of the poor stepchild in this system because, again, we've treated addiction with our limited resources as an acute problem and not a, a lifetime problem. By recovery support, I mean building community where people can go on a Friday night, instead of going to the bar they used to go to, they can go to the 4D Recovery Center or the Alano Recovery Center in Portland and find access to recovery support meetings like AA and NA or Wellbriety or Dharma, as well as find workshops on how to clear up their record or their financial mess, all the things that trigger people that are in early recovery, but also are a consequence of our disease over a really long span. We know from the U.S. Surgeon General that if we keep someone in recovery for 60 months, so 5 years, your chance of relapse goes down to 15%. If there were an addiction doctor, any addiction doctor will tell you there is no other chronic health condition with that level of return on investment, that if you invest in it for 5 years, you can walk away and the relapse rate is only 15%. But we as a state do not have a recovery support system. Oregon Health Authority has gotten better over the years to fund where there is some level of recovery support, but what we need is a system of care. And I'll just punctuate the absence of a statewide system of care by noting that the Criminal Justice Commission came out with a report in 2019 trying to look at the efficacy of the current system. And what they found was it was fractured and incomplete. And by that, I mean, if you look at Multnomah County, where we have one treatment bed per 1,100 population. Now, as a metric, no one knows if that's the right ratio in order to address the addiction crisis in Oregon, but it is the best ratio in the state. Comparatively, next door in Washington County, we have one treatment bed per 12,000 people. And in Clackamas County, we have one treatment bed per 36,000 people. Hence, no matter how much money Multnomah County is putting out of their general fund into the system of care in Multnomah County, because people are coming from Washington and Clackamas County to get the help they need, we still have 3 and 4 week wait times. You still can't get into detox on the morning that you need to be there. And so we need a statewide system of care, which is what the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission has designed. The next step towards doing that is to figure out how do we implement that system while at the same time reducing the fact that we have the third highest addiction rate in the country. And Oregon Recovers and a large spectrum of stakeholders have proposed the Addiction Crisis Recovery Act the legislature is currently thinking about. If you go to our website, OregonRecovers.org, you can find out all the information you need about both Oregon Recovers, but also the Addiction Crisis Recovery Act. And what it proposes to do is three things. Number one, to reduce harmful consumption, which then leads to our high addiction rate. So, and do that by raising the price of alcohol. We have the lowest beer and wine taxes in the country, and we have some of the cheapest alcohol on the bottom shelf for sale. We've not raised the beer tax since Jimmy Carter was president. We've not raised the wine tax since Ronald Reagan was president. And because it's not tied to inflation, in fact, the alcohol industry has gotten a tax break every year, because it's consistently gone down to the point of it being nothing. But the goal here is not simply to tax that substance. It's in fact to reduce underage drinking and binge drinking by raising the price. And just as with tobacco is designed to raise the price in order to reduce harmful consumption, we want to do that with alcohol, which will immediately reduce the demand for the existing health system of care. And as Dr. Richardson referenced earlier, also immediately reduce that $4.8 billion cost of excessive drinking on the Oregon economy and to the Oregon taxpayers. And we're talking about excessive drinking. We're not talking about moderate drinking. Raising your beer or wine by 21 cents or 31 cents is not going to be impactful or meaningful to you as a moderate drinker, but it will reduce the level of consumption by underage drinkers and binge drinkers, the two leading contributors to addiction rates. The second part is then to take that money and fund comprehensively, instead of with Band-Aids as we have over the years, as we have a little more money, we fund this, a little more money, we fund this. Dr. Richardson's commission has designed a blueprint for a system of care. We need to put money into that. By raising the price of the retail price of alcohol 20%, we generate $746 billion per biennium. And the way ACRA distributes that money is aligned with the plan, but it specifically increases prevention by about 100%, because we're currently only paying half of what the CDC recommends, spending only half of what the CDC recommends. It makes investments in the healthcare system and helps educate doctors and nurses and schools and everybody else that needs to begin to understand how to intervene in someone's addiction before it has criminal consequences. Expands the number of treatment and detox beds by over 2,500 across the state, as well as over 3,000 outpatient programs. It creates recovery housing so that people don't have to go back to the crack house where they lived before they went to treatment. And they can build the community they need to have long-term recovery. So it does a whole bunch of really meaningful things. But the other challenge in the system has been the lack of accountability. Money goes in and it sort of goes into these tentacles within the different state agencies. And we have no ability to know, is it being effective and how is it being spent? And so the third part and critical part of ACRA is that it takes this $746 million and puts it into a lockbox or a bank account at the Oregon Health Authority that Dr. Richardson's commission has control over. They are empowered by legislation to biannually design and improve the system of care. And so they should be responsible for allocating the money to build up that system of care. So again, what the Addiction Crisis Recovery Act does is it reduces excessive alcohol consumption and thereby reducing our addiction rates. It fully funds a new system of care, and it creates much greater accountability into the system so that our tax dollars are being spent wisely. The other side very quickly has said it's a 2,800% increase in your beer and wine costs. Well, 2,800% increase of virtually nothing is virtually nothing. Currently, anyone watching this who's going to go buy a beer tonight is going to spend less than a penny in tax on that beer, less than a penny. What ACRA does is a 2,800% increase of half a penny is 21 cents. And a 2,800% increase of 3 cents, which is the wine tax, is 31 cents. So don't believe the hype that you hear from the alcohol industry or the distributors of the alcohol industry. And instead think about, what are you willing to pay? Are you willing to pay another 20 cents in order to build a system of care that reduces our addiction rate and actually provides your family members, your colleagues, your friends with the help and assistance they need? So I would urge everyone to go to OregonRecovers.org. You can click on the button at the top that says the Addiction Crisis Recovery Act. And if you support what we're doing, your legislators need to hear from you ASAP. There's a button there where you can do it, and we'll help you figure out who to send it to. But the alcohol industry is inundating legislators with a whole bunch of misinformation, and they need to hear from folks who have family members who are suffering from this disease. And with that, it's a great honor. I will hand it over to Dr. Brown.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate being here with everyone and, you know, feel honored to be in the conversation. And I am Dr. Tiffany Brown. I teach at the University of Oregon, and my kind of main gig is training couples and family therapists, so master's level, and also working with counseling psychology doctoral students. And so my kind of piece of the pie here is mostly from a frame of educating kind of up and coming therapists who will be sitting across from folks who are either needing help or love someone or is connected to someone who needs support. A little bit of my history is I'm not a person in long-term recovery, although I'm very vested in the recovery movement based on family members and friends. I started out as a master's student thinking that I would never work with addiction and recovery, and actually believed so strongly in that I thought, oh, why am I even taking a class? I'm just going to find really good colleagues who know about this, and I'm just always going to send clients who have those needs to them. So when I went on to get my doctoral degree, I actually intended to work in a totally different specialty area and had a mentor who said basically that my initial beliefs were false and that I needed to learn a few things. And so I'm very thankful to his guidance for taking me with him along his journey and working with one of the top collegiate recovery programs in the country at Texas Tech University. And so I was able to learn about recovery mostly from collegiate level students who had either been to treatment or in the process of going to treatment, and were also navigating kind of being back at school and what it meant to be in a college environment while navigating recovery. And so at that time, I just started listening and switched my specialty, started working at a treatment center, and became much more aware of how big of an issue it was, and didn't really know until I was able to sit across from people who were telling their stories and were able to kind of talk about the many ways that they were seeking help over time, but either were being arrested or criminalized or didn't have access to treatment. And that was in a treatment center that was kind of a higher access point in terms of being a privatized treatment center. So folks were having difficulty getting into a private treatment center based on a whole ton of resources. I started thinking about what does this mean for folks who don't have the type of access that folks with insurance and money do. I spent some time at the national level working with the Association of Recovery in Higher Education, which supports building more collegiate recovery programs across the country. There are now about 133 kind of ebbs and flows, around 133, 136 collegiate recovery programs across the US, and many more that are building. This has been kind of an imperative part of kind of the aftercare model to ensure that people have support systems in place post-treatment and while, you know, pursuing goals as either, you know, a young adult or even later in life, depending on kind of how their story unfolded and if going back to school is something that is relevant to them. I've also worked with SAMHSA in terms of their brass tacks process and working with collegiate recovery programs from that angle too. So that has been a big part of my time and energy professionally. I think what I care about most is what does it mean when we're sitting across from clients? So kind of the therapist role in me kind of chimes into both what do I do in terms of my clients and the people that I'm consulting with, but also educating therapists in terms of sitting across from clients and being able to have that conversation in a way that is not stigmatized and is really opening up the door to have a conversation that is different than most other conversations. So rather than tell me how many drinks you have a week, which is often the conversation that happens at a doctor's office, which can get to conversations that are relevant, it also cannot based on how the question's being asked and if there's a follow-up that that entertains conversation. And so I really focus my work as an educator on how do we sit across from folks and engage in dialogue in a way that is inviting and welcoming and destigmatizing while understanding how historically racist, the kind of the pathway to getting people clean and sober has been? Who have we missed along the way when we've tried to arrest ourselves out of a crisis? So we spend a lot of time in that realm in my classroom specifically to kind of step aside from kind of the day-to-day and think about the larger historical context of how we've gotten it wrong, and how much it matters to pause and think about who am I to my client, and what does my role mean in terms of supporting someone in either reducing use or stopping use, depending on kind of what the situation is for the client. Having had a family history and really significantly hurt relationships because of use and the lack of supports and decisions of family members who for kind of their own path have not you know, chosen recovery or been able to get into recovery. I'm also very aware of the trauma and the impact that happens for folks who love someone who's struggling, and definitely in from a kind of chronic disease place too, of knowing, you know, really being there when people want to get help, but also how do we help and support loved ones. And so a good portion of my work is consulting with therapists and others about how we provide support services to folks who potentially are making the problem or are making the problem much worse, either by enabling behaviors, codependency behaviors, and certainly kind of that approach of ultimatums and stigmatizing the role of substance use from a place of rather than intervening with compassion and with options, intervening with, you know, such strict and strong responses that we're not actually rebuilding relationships and providing openings for people to get support. In a lot of my experience, it's the questions that I get are, you know, from therapists who say, I have a client who's talking about their kid or partner or sibling who has this particular issue, but we don't know what to do. And so I think about all the education that master's level therapists get, doctoral level therapists get. We get one class, I get one class to teach for 10 weeks. They have 30 hours in a seat with me to learn all there is to know about substance use from the very baseline. Kind of what is it, how do we talk about it, to intervention, to the family dynamics. We spend a good portion of time focusing on stigma and kind of how racism has created such a problem across the country and certainly in Oregon in terms of helping people get to services. And what I notice every year is, and I just finished teaching the class last week, is I always feel inadequate. I feel like I did not teach them the thing they need to teach, and out of all the folks to teach them, I feel like I have a lot to offer, but I always feel scrambled to be able to get the best information in front of them, knowing that I only have, you know, 10 weeks to do it. And these are folks that are going to be sitting across from clients who are going to say, I need help, or I know someone that needs help. And the question that often comes up is, what do we do now? So if someone, even at the point of asking for help and the conversation has emerged and someone's ready for that, there's oftentimes a question mark of like, okay, so who do we call now? Where do we go? How do they get access? And what is the best way for them to move forward? And then I think what's challenging for therapists is then we're trusting the treatment center world to kind of take it from there. And sometimes on our side of things, we hear stories of treatment centers that are ineffective, that aren't working, where people feel really ostracized, they feel very shamed for their use. And it's hard as clinicians to then want to send other clients back. And that's challenging sometimes to know, is that someone's kind of unique experience in terms of their part of their story? Is that something that is kind of congruent with the treatment center in general? We don't really have good relationships, I think, between therapists and treatment centers to know, if I'm in an outpatient role, who are my allies that are in kind of residential services where I can trust that where they're going is going to get good care and worth their money, especially when we know people are mortgaging homes. They are having to quit their jobs or get fired from their jobs, totally shift what's happening to be able to get a foot in the door, given how expensive treatment is for folks. And then that doesn't even take into account, how do we take care of folks who are in a position of not being able to afford it, who are unhoused, who don't have allies or support services for when they leave treatment as well. And so I think a lot about how do we help people get to treatment? How do we trust that when they get there, they will be well cared for? And then how do we ensure that there's an aftercare process that, as others have mentioned, we know that those 5 years are so important in terms of having systems in place to support the process. How do we do that in a way that is systematic and is contextual to the person who's receiving services and isn't just expecting clients or our neighbors to just map onto a system because the system has said, well, this is just what we do. It may not be evidence-based. It may not even be effective, but it might just be the way that the system is operating in terms of, you know, clients coming to them and be kind of pushed through this big treatment center that may or may not be kind of the best situation for the client in terms of kind of what they need or their identity, the trauma that they've experienced, the relationships that they have in their life that are kind of managing or supporting kind of the use. I just always come back to how we can't arrest our way out of a crisis. And we've tried that. It's ineffective. That continues to be the way that people talk about addiction. And, you know, we just need to arrest more. We need to have harsher laws and harsher penalties. And it's really frustrating as a therapist to know that people's use is contextualized. It's a health crisis. We spend dollar after dollar and provide so many avenues for help for folks with other health conditions. And yes, there are a ton of disparities, but we sure do make it impossible, I think, for people to get well unless they meet this kind of upper echelon of kind of knowing the right people and having the right contacts or having the right amount of money to get in the door. I think in, you know, one of my strong kind of callings, I guess, is to think about how do we best support therapists. If I think about my pocket of the work, how do we support therapists who are sitting across from people to be able to have conversations that are opening up the door for the desire to get help or to stop use or to try to stop use and have that conversation in a way that is supportive, evidence-based, it's effective, and then allows us to be able to connect back with folks so we can ensure that they got what they needed once they either turn towards a treatment route or turn towards 12-step groups or turn towards any other kind of mutual aid support system. And I think in Oregon, we have a lot of work to do, as many of us have said, to ensure that we're aware of, you know, one size does not fit all. And we've got to think about what is best for each person that seeks support, while also acknowledging that therapists and treatment centers and educators like me do not always have all the answers. And we've got to turn towards our communities to teach us and inform us of how do we make the process of getting help much more welcoming and possible. And with that, I'll turn it back over.
Thank you all so much. We've got some time for Q&A, so let's just dive right in. A lot of you spoke about sort of what we can do to solve the problem. I'm going to take us back one step and ask a question about how we got here. What is it about Oregon that has led us to be sort of one of the, if not the worst in the nation on so many of these metrics? Are there other problems, whether it's in the social safety net or otherwise, other risk factors that Oregon has that maybe other states don't? And any of you can take this.
Well, I'll jump in because I referenced this a little earlier. Both the 2000 and the 2008 recessions saw a decimation of the number of certified alcohol and drug counselors and outpatient programs. But more importantly, I think that Oregon used to be known to be one of the best prevention states in the country. And today we're by far the worst in terms of we have virtually no resources. The Center for Disease Control recommends that a state the size of Oregon spend about $40 million a year, and we spend less than 20 on a full statewide prevention program. And so the money that is handed out isn't linked to any statewide outcomes, and hence we have the third highest addiction rate in the country. The second part of that is we have the lowest beer and wine taxes, which is the portal towards, as I said earlier, excessive consumption. Those taxes haven't gone up at all because the alcohol industry has prevented that from happening. And as the net result is that we consume a much higher level of alcohol at a much earlier age. As Dr. Richardson said, we have the third highest addiction rate, not for adults, for people 12 and older. And so it's the power of the alcohol industry in the legislature, as well as back-to-back recessions where we saw budgets cut and not restored because there wasn't the both the political will and I would say the cognizance of, you're spending all this money on foster care and incarceration and homelessness, and the leading predictor of those three things is untreated addiction, and we have ignored untreated addiction. So I'm not saying that dealing with our addiction crisis is going to solve those other three things, but it sure is going to put much less of a burden on those three systems.
I'd like to jump in to that as well. Part of the reason why we're here is really bad public policy. The war on drugs turned out to be a war on communities, and particularly communities of color. And I think those chickens are coming home to roost now. The other thing that I think is also happening is that our budget cycle is a 2-year budget cycle. And so our leaders are not looking down the road far enough to anticipate the movement of our economy for good or bad. This 2-year budget cycle really focuses on the next 2 years and not the next 10, 15, and 20 years. And I think it also lends itself to, if it costs $100 to deliver a service, the legislature is going to give us $66. That is just fundamentally the practice that's done. We're always 1/3 behind what it actually costs to deliver a service, and that's cumulative. So our treatment providers are always behind the eight ball trying to catch up to actually do the cost that's necessary to run programs. The other thing I think is that we're short-sighted. We forget. You know, prevention is not really being utilized in our state, yet we have some of the best prevention programs in the country. We know that $1 spent for prevention saves us $7, yet we spend less than 1% in prevention. And I think our budget cycle helps us maintain that, those kinds of mistakes. So I think those are some of the things that are also impacting why we are where we are.
I'll add just a little to that. I agree with everything that's been said. I think one of the other things that we're not doing well as a state is we're not funding schools and funding after-school programs. And so we've got to give kids more opportunities to be seen and heard by adults and connect to adults and get positive reinforcement so that they're having experiences that are kind of pro-social and helping, you know, kids become kind of better citizens of their communities in the sense that they, you know, have more options to connect with people. They have more ways to cope with stress. They have more ways to be seen and heard by adults. And so when we're cutting school programs and we're making education kind of a low priority in terms of the budget, we're also taking away opportunities for kids who were already marginalized within their school communities to not have kind of a place to be or go, where then substances become even more attractive when we're looking at ways to kind of cope and navigate really tough life situations. And so I think the more that we continue to not fund education and cut out music and art and activities and after school programs, that's part of that, I think, ripple effect that leads us into this crisis again and again.
Thank you. Corinne, you have a question.
I do. Thank you. I have many. This is such a fascinating conversation. Thank you to all of our speakers today on this program. Wonderful information that you're sharing. Many of you just touched on a few of the questions that I have, but one to come back to. Mr. Marshall, you mentioned that Oregon is among the lowest in terms of our taxation as it relates to alcohol, and that some of the opposition to the ACRA is claiming that then we would become the highest. I'm curious if you and Dr. Richardson, Dr. Brown, Ms. Morgan could speak to other places that have done a better job of aligning an economy that takes a lot of pride in its beer and wine and spirits production with solutions to addiction. Is there a middle ground or better policies and practices that other states or cities or jurisdictions have put in place?
It's an excellent question. The challenge you have is, in most cases, the revenue from the sale of alcohol does not actually go to addiction services. It goes into the general fund, and then they make decisions. Most other states have a sales tax. And so you have a much higher degree of money going into the general fund as well. But I would also say, because the alcohol industry is saying, but you know, Oregon and Washington, we'd be so much higher. Well, we have the third highest addiction rate. So we should be taxing more, number one. But number two, you don't make repairs to your house based on what your neighbor thinks they need to make repairs on, right? You make repairs to your house based on what your house needs, where you live, so that you can take care of your family. And so we would go from having the lowest, when you factor in no sales tax, the lowest beer tax, second lowest wine tax, to some of the highest in the country, primarily because we haven't taken any action for 40 years. And as a consequence, we have the third highest addiction rate and rank virtually last in access to treatment. And it's costing us $4.8 billion. If we can create an equilibrium over the next 5 to 10 years, perhaps we can then subsequently go back and reduce the tax relative to other states. But that the other states shouldn't be the metric. The metric should be how many Oregonians are suffering today because they or their family member is not getting either the prevention message they need so that they don't become addicted, or once they are, that they're getting access to the services they need so that their family can be healthier. And we as taxpayers are not taking on this huge burden just so local breweries and wineries don't have to pay more than a penny a beer.
Great questions. I also want to remind or point out, I guess, that, you know, we talk a lot about opiates and opioid, you know, misuse. But we don't talk about alcohol misuse and alcohol addiction the way we need to. Alcohol kills 5 or more people every day in the state of Oregon, and that is more than double the amount of opioid-related deaths that we see on a regular basis. Alcohol is one of the most dangerous drugs to detox off of. You can die from detoxing off alcohol. And we don't talk about that. And so that's why this legislation is important. That's why addressing this is important. You know, and I also want to point out too that, you know, that we don't think about alcohol as, you know, as an addictive substance, right? I mean, people in recovery do, and people that treat people with alcohol use disorder do, but as a general rule, just like when COVID happened and OLCC decided to authorize the home delivery of alcohol, like no one in this state would ever authorize the home delivery of heroin, but it's the same thing. It's worse, honestly. And so as a culture, we need to change that, right? And recognize that because alcohol is so readily available, it is more dangerous than other substances that are out there. And I can tell you from all the prevention talks and talks I've done at local high schools, you know, I'm in a classroom full of, you know, 30 plus kids, and I ask them, who in here knows somebody that's had their life affected by drugs or alcohol? And every hand goes up. And every addiction screening that I do in the course of my my job here, people talk about trying alcohol just like I did at 12, 13, 14 years old, trying marijuana at 12, 13, 14 years old. And those are the two substances that you can walk into any store and buy. Like that's backwards, in my opinion. Not to pontificate, but.
Thank you. Any other takes on the effects of Measure 110?
I'll take a quick stab at it. You know, speaking as a person with a criminal history and, you know, history of substance abuse, you know, and all the consequences that go along with addiction, you know, I agree that decriminalizing and leading people to treatment services and recovery support services is definitely the direction we need to go. But, you know, doing that without any kind of structure or plan is, you know, in my mind, going to have some really negative consequences for this state. And, you know, what I can tell you about what we need to do differently is, I mean, as I said, every time I was arrested, not one time did a police officer say, hey, would you like help with your drug addiction? I'm tired of coming to your house and checking in with you because of domestic violence, or I'm tired of arresting you for X, Y, and Z crimes. Not one time when I went to the hospital with drug-related abscesses or any other medical consequences due to my use, And Dr. Brown, you referenced this. There was a one little tiny box on my little intake screening form that says, do you use drugs or alcohol? Yes or no? And of course I said no. Like, I'm always going to say no, but nobody ever actually sat with me and said, like, I know you're using drugs. Like, it's clear, it was plainly obvious that I was using drugs. And I think, you know, the idea behind Measure 110 to get people the treatment and services that they need is a beautiful idea. But as a state, I don't know that we're ready to actually talk about addiction in that real and raw kind of a way that's really going to effectively help people.
Thank you all so much. An incredibly important topic for Oregonians to consider and to take action on. And so thank you for the action items and for the work you do every day to try to solve this problem in our families and in our communities. That is all for us today from the City Club of Eugene. Thank you as always for joining, and we'll see you next time.
This has been our March 19th, 2021 program, Falling Behind, Solving Oregon's Addiction Crisis. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our Diamond sponsors. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, our mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. LCC provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. I would also like to acknowledge our gold sponsors, Dr. Sandy Ibarra of the Hearing Associates, Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union, Homes for Good Housing Agency. Before we thank our speakers today, I have a few more quick announcements. Thank you to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Pack Info and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography, and a special thank you to public radio station KLCC FM 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page. If you are a City Club of Eugene member, you can ask a question at a future taping of our programs. If you are not yet a member, you can join and then participate. More information is on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Next week, our program focuses on how can we achieve universal access to healthcare. Speakers will include Susan Bailey, MD, President of the American Medical Association, and Tom Cooney, MD, Chair-elect of the Board of Regents, American College of Physicians. The session will be moderated by John Kitzhaber, MD, former governor of the state of Oregon. This next program is sponsored by Oregon Physicians for a National Health Program, advocating better care to more people for less money in Oregon and nationally. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, I would like to thank today's speaker for a great program, Tiffany Brown, Mike Marshall, Terry Morgan, and Reginald Richardson. Thank you very much. This concludes today's program. Be well and stay safe.